Always Record, Episode 6.
Look out your window. The grass ain't green. It's kind of yellow. See what I mean? Look up your chimney. The sky ain't blue. It's kind of yellow. You know it's true.
I was able to get onto Facebook. It's funny, your internet kicked out, and I was having so much trouble getting into Facebook. So, but I just got on. I saw what Bill said. It's pretty interesting, actually.
The brain is fried.
Yeah.
Yeah. I fucking fried my brain this weekend. I lost my shit. I went out to an annual event that I've been going to year after year after year that I've never had a bad time at. And I first couple nights, I had a great time. I danced my ass off. I took a bunch of psychedelics. I rocked it. And then I just had like a whole, I was already spent. Like I was done, like energetically. I've been tripping all day, and then my girlfriend was like, here, have another hit, and I was like ready to go to bed when I took it. And that night I it was okay for a while. It felt like I felt like tired or whatever, but then like when we went to go lay down, she fell asleep, and I just fucking laid for like 6 hours just having like a hellishly intense introspective nightmare. And like basically I believe I pretty much worked out the Mystery Babylon that night. But oh my god! And then we laughed.
Do you think you'd be able to explain it?
Yeah. Yeah. Everything is fucking. There's all these pieces and they fused together, and it started because a friend of mine. Who I've known for years and I hardly fucking get to talk to anymore. Just like I was walking by and he was like, dude, you're the only person I know who'd get the fucking Tree of Life tattooed on their kidney. Like a statement of like the weird spot to put it, you know? And I was like, huh. And like I got a couple tattoos that I really haven't given much thought to since I got them. Like, I got these tattoos, like, what, 5 years ago or something?
I understand. I have the same situation.
And that night, I just tripped out on the placement and meaning of my two tattoos. And it was just, like, total craziness, you know? And the next day, we just left the party in the middle of the party and fucking jammed for Harbin Hot Spring, which is just, like, you know, mineral springs. That was like 100 miles from there. That was a good idea. We got in a fight on the way and it was all fucking super intense. But we got there and soaked, and it's like, they have like I forget what it is. I think it's 115 degree hot tub that you go from that into a cold plunge, which is spring water directly pouring out from the source. Like, and so it turned into a huge healing experience, but I had a really hard time. I started to, lose my mind a little bit. But it's probably helpful.
Oh, I can immensely sympathize. I don't know. I feel like things are really intense right now. You know, not in a bad way, like totally working shit out, but I do feel that things are really intense.
Yeah, there was like no way. It was like it felt when I was laying there that there was like I could skirt around this issue as long as I wanted, really. But there was something inside of me that like wanted to like keep going into it, and I couldn't get away from it. And I mean, I suppose I ultimately could, but there was no point in getting away from it. So I like had to work out some crazy occult shit.
So maybe that's a place to start if you want. What did you figure out with the Babylon work?
Well, it had to do with
Or I take that back. Is it the Babylon working you figured out, or just the meaning of Babylon in a sort of larger sense?
in a larger sense,
Okay.
and Christianity and the Golden Dawn, and basically what I was feeling, the meaning behind the as particular associations with the planets, meaning the spherot, and the pathways, meaning the spherot, and how they were changed, and basically what those implications are. And it started because I mean, this is on a personal level. It was that my tattoo is on my lower, it's on my abdomen on my left side, and basically that would be Hode, right? So yeah, let me buzz something out here real quick.
It's interesting because so there's sort of two mirrored versions of the tree superimposed on Adam Kadmon. There's the older version, and then as I understand it, Golden Dawn sort of reversed it, sort of mirrored it.
Yeah, it's weird, like the specifics of the matter. And I was doing my best at the time to visualize in my head the two. Well, there's actually more than two, because there's the Ari version too. So, but then the thing is that the one that I'm considering, I mean, I could go in like basically four main directions with how they're changed around. But what interests me more than any is that Ramak, who I've been studying with my rabbi, was a main influence on Israel Regardae. And Israel Regardae named one of his books the Garden of Pomegranates, which is basically Ramak's like magnum opus. So that got, and then Israel Regardae was one of the founders of Hollywood, which is something that I didn't know until my rabbi actually pointed that out and told me all about it. I was like, huh, because I don't usually think of that. He was like, no, he was in Hollywood when Hollywood was really just started getting going. I was like, huh, and that all these people went to him for all this shit. And I'm like, huh, that's really strange. But basically, I was tripping out on the fact that I got the symbol of Mercury tattooed on my arm, on my forearm. And then it struck me that, that would be Chesed.
Right. Can I
So
ask which arm, your right arm or your left arm?
my right arm.
So on your forearm?
On my forearm, yeah.
That's so funny. On my right forearm, I have it's actually a Japanese cartoon character. There's the little twin stars, they're called. And they're just like, Hello Kitty, same type thing. So I have the girl, and my wife has the boy. She has it on her left arm. But then I realized
Huh.
one day that essentially, because it's a twin star, I essentially have Sirius on my right forearm. Right?
Huh. Yeah.
So, I mean, that wasn't my point, wasn't to get a tattoo of Sirius, but that's so where you have Mercury, I have Sirius.
Right. So, okay, so this is where it gets interesting, is that Tiferet for Ramak is Mercury. And then the Golden Dawn makes that into the sun, which is crazy because the Golden Dawn is, the Golden Dawn. Do you have a picture? Can you see me?
I can
Are you
see
looking?
you, yeah.
Okay. So here's like, I don't know if you can see this,
Yeah.
but this is a book of the Golden Dawn,
Mm
right? This is like Kabbalah, the Golden Dawn. And they put the sun right there over Tiferet, obviously.
Correct, yeah.
And this is the Golden Dawn symbol, you know, where you have the Golden Dawn, right?
Correct.
So that's what it is. But then I'm tripping out on, like, basically Mercury is the closest planet to the sun, right? And that's the symbolism of Mercury. That's why it's associated. Jesus Christ is associated with Mercury. First of all, Jesus, it has two initiations on mountains in the gospel story. And there is this report that I'd read a while back that actually incorporated into something a long time ago. And the guy who wrote this article, like, contacted me and was like, thanks for getting it, blah, 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 whatever. But he had written this article about the two mountains being, you have Hermes, you have Mount Hermon is named after Hermes. And Jesus has this transfiguration on that mountain.
Right.
So Hermes, Mercury, right? And so there's this whole, and then the other one is Pan. And if you go to these mountains now, you can find all these remnants of Pan worship and worship of Hermes, you know, outside of Judea. It's super fucking weird.
The fact that, so then they would place his transformative experiences there, where he's sort of, so Pan is the all. So it's like getting in touch with the all. And of course, Hermes is sort of the messenger of the gods, the one that sort of would bring you to that heavenly sphere or bring down the heavenly information. So either way, it's right. The same kind of initiation.
Right. And Pan is the dweller on the threshold.
Right.
And so it's when he's facing his two biggest tribulations is what is he actually facing? And so it's encoded in the meaning, if you know those mounts, which at the time, if you were familiar, it would be more straightforward. Now we have to dig all this stuff up and we're like, oh, well, fuck. But I was just finding it interesting in my head of all these representations of Jesus with the halo behind him. And I've heard so many different takes on that it's a fucking mushroom, that it's whatever, you know, a spaceship. And I was like, what if it's the sun? And he's before the sun as Mercury.
Because
Mercury's the closest planet to the sun. I was just tripping out on that. But then I was looking at its implications in terms of Mercury being Tiferet, and that the sun is actually Gevura, according to Ramak. And then Chesed is the moon. He has them above.
Right.
And so I was thinking about what an eclipse or an alignment means in this case. Like the beginning of 2001, when everything falls into line, what that means in terms of the tree. Because first of all, what I'm reading about the tree in the older text is that it's a recognition that they're all in a spiral motion, that there's nothing static about them, and that they're all that they go through different phases with each other. And so I'm thinking about this whirling model of the tree and what all that means in terms of, I think about cycles and things becoming more malleable during those cycles. And there are no planetary attributions to Chokhmah, Bina, and Keter in the old text. Those are left aside as far as planetary associations go, because they don't belong to the seven lower spherot, which is the, you know,
because they're not of this world. They're the heaven beyond the heaven.
Right. And so the Golden Dawn goes and has, what do they have here?
I think they use Saturn as Bina.
Yeah, they have Pluto as Keter, Saturn as Bina, and Neptune as Chokhmah, and Uranus is Da'at, which isn't a sphero, which is kind of funny. But anyways, there's all these levels to it. And I was considering the fact that, first of all, Jupiter is Yesod for Ramak, and then Saturn is Malkut. But then the way that, okay, let me see here. So then you have Mercury is Hod, while Mars is Hod in the old one. Mars is the sun in the old one, whereas now Mars is Gevura. So it was just, and then Jupiter is Chesed now for the Golden Dawn. But then Jupiter is Yesod. So there is basically all this weird implication stuff. And then I'm looking at the Ari too, and the Ari has what was Mercury as Hod was Jupiter before, and so they took a complete, like, I don't know. I was just going around and around and around and around with the implications of the different planetary associations, and it required some, like, super crazy-ass meditation. But one interesting thing that got me was, on a personal level, which isn't Mystery Babylon, but it's my own coming to look at how I'm ahead of myself in terms of a tattoo, because I believe that. I've talked to other people who have had that same experience where you get a tattoo and then it tells you what it means later, you know, and that I got a tattoo on my placement, which would be Hode, which would be Mercury, and then I happen to get Mercury on my right arm. My right arm would be Chesed, which would be Mercy, and then that's, you know, I have the whole tree there, but then that was, Hode was associated with Mars. And so in a sense, it's like taking the sun, which is the heart, which is Tiferet, and extending it through the arm to bring Mercy, which is Chesed, to Mars. So I was just, you know, I don't know. I was tripping out on that. It kind of, you know.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, we can take this a few different ways. I mean, obviously, alchemically, it probably makes more sense to have Saturn as Malkuth and Jupiter as Yesod. I mean, taking the sort of mythology of it, of Jupiter is the sort of first thing to really break out of Saturn. After Saturn eats his children, it's Jupiter that breaks out of him.
Right.
So now, if Saturn is led, you know, so it's not only is Saturn very often it's one of the first gods, alchemically, if it's led, it's sort of that, you know, that first stage that you can sort of start to develop out of. So that it makes sense that way. But it's funny because actually just a few days ago, what I was writing about was this sort of chain of the mythology is that Uranus is really a spirit of the air. He's sort of, which almost makes sense to put him as Da'at only because he's kind of ethereal. You know, he's sort of intangible. He's just a spirit of the air. But he almost replaces Nuet, you know, that same sort of concept of this sort of sky god. It's just a masculine version. And so what happens is Uranus comes every night and mates with Mother Earth, Gaia, and she keeps having all these children, but they're like these horrible, disgusting beast children. You know, these are all the sort of old world monsters. And he's so disgusted by his children that he imprisons them in the earth, which of course is God. I mean, you know, this when since we've anthropomorphized it, he's not just burying them in the earth, he's sort of burying them back into their mother. So she's in immense pain. She gives Saturn the sickle that we always see Saturn with. She actually makes it out of the earth, gives it to him, and he cuts off Uranus's balls. So he cuts off his dad's balls. And then, so now he's, you know, he's the king. And what ends up happening, but then Saturn ends up becoming this is what I'm essentially, the concept of my book is the idea of this sort of cycle, because now he's overthrown the king, but now he does the same thing. Now he hates his fucking children and he's afraid of them and he eats his children. So one of them, being Jupiter, breaks out of him. Then what does Jupiter do? Jupiter ends up eating his fucking children. So you have this sort of constant repetitive cycle of, you know, sort of killing the father, marrying the mother, you know, this is the Oedipus sort of thing, but then constantly becoming this sort of tyrant that they overthrew. Now, what's really interesting to me is, after Jupiter eats his children, it's Athena or Minerva. Sorry, it's you know, the if we're doing Roman names, it's Minerva that breaks out of Jupiter. Mm-hmm. So, taking it back to Greek, this is you know, Zeus and Athena. There is the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Michael over at Gosporn's been writing about them, and it occurs to me that what they show as the icon for League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is Pallas Athena. It's this sort of helmeted female warrior. It's definitely Pallas Athena. And she has a question mark coming out of her head. And if you actually look at the old Greek artwork of Athena coming out of Zeus's head, the way they depict it isn't like really like an explosion out of the head. It's sort of like she's just like kind of sitting on his head, like a small her sitting on his head. Mm-hmm. So if we take this kind of cycle. And this, of course, relates to the Tree of Life, the same way that at the sort of crown you have another Malkuth, you have another tree growing out of another tree. So we have this same sort of cycle, right? Well, if Athena came out of Zeus's head, and you have the same cycle, one would imagine there's something to come out of her head, the next part of the cycle. So when you see the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, where you have Pallas Athena with this sort of question mark coming off the front of her helmet, it occurred to me, this was just this morning, I was like, oh my God, what he's saying is like, what comes out of, what is the next part of that step? What is the next emanation of that? And, you know, the fact that you have that same question, instead of the place of a head, you have this sort of question mark, isn't only the logo for League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, but now the logo for Anonymous, right? This this hacker, quote-unquote hacker group, with all its ties. You know, interestingly, you have the same sort of imagery of that being almost the next emanation. And I think that's fascinating.
Right, and that it becomes the very thing, because the nature of what is implied in it coming out of.
Right.
It's like that they drive it home with that expression, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you're growing out of something, that is essentially the elements that you're made of, exactly. What's interesting to me is you mentioned the idea of having a tattoo and not knowing what it means. The first tattoo I ever got was this symbol that I used to just draw over and over again as a child, and I never knew what it meant. It was just sort of this thing that spoke to me. And I drew it for years, and I don't know, I was probably like 17, 18, and I decided that was going to be my first tattoo. And I put it, it's actually on my right shoulder. Seeing many years later, the first time I saw the alchemical symbol for Saturn, it is almost exactly the alchemical symbol for Saturn. Hmm. So I have that on my right shoulder.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. So this is the thing that, this is the other level of it that's, you know, you probably are already thinking about, but the it's not just a symbol, but the representation of the atom.
Yes.
How it is the star.
Very
you
much.
Have the six-pointed star, very much so. And how the tree itself, as we know the tree, is the split Adam.
Yes.
And the seraphim are connected into it. And so then that's the fall from the garden, where you have the cherubim and all of that, and the flaming sword, which rotates, which Lilith is born out of, who's the other Eve, right? And so it was just so apparent what is implied in all of that, and the fact that it's a mushroom cloud that comes out of the atom when it's split, and how the Tree of Life is the Adam, and how, like, I basically ran this by my rabbi, and he actually got kind of upset, because it's just like, you know, for one thing, he doesn't consider Oppenheimer to be, or, you know, any of these guys to be that, you know. I mean, basically, what I ran by him was, we're studying this thing, and we come across the word Gollum. Mm. And I'm just like, I am not buying this idea. And it wasn't saying this here, it was using the term as like a formless mass. And I'm just like, I'm not buying this idea of this like clay mud baby thing as being all a golem can be. I mean, what are we talking about? And so we're going into the nitty gritty of what classifies a golem. And they have stories, I think, in the Gomorrah or whatever, of people eating golems. They'll make them and then eat them, and they're like animals, basically. Like, you can have a cow golem and all this stuff, and I'm like, okay. But then,
can I just interject a second and say how much does that tie into that same cycle of, it's essentially you're creating the golem. It's essentially your child, for lack of a better term. So it goes back to the idea of eating your children or eating your creation.
Completely, yeah. No, I'm on on the same tip. Yeah. So yeah, and then the idea of it being a formless intelligence, that first of all has no soul, as we know soul, like you say, like a nefesh, if you have the spirit, but then it has a life at the same time, and it is an intelligence. It has an intelligence. And so I'm like, how, like, we're talking about an intelligence that is etheric, but not like angel etheric, not like next level, like, you know, be on the other side, but in this realm. And I'm just like, how is that not a drug? You know, how could we not be talking about a drug? And everything actually,
particularly if you're ingesting it.
Yeah, if you're ingesting it too. Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of was the thing in our communication. It's like, okay, well, I guess it could be a drug.
Does it? I mean, I assume the same thing has occurred to you before, that reading the story of, you mentioned Christ and his tribulations, it occurs to me that him wandering in the desert is very much a vision quest. When you talk when you talk about, you're going to wander in the desert and meet angels and demons and struggle with all these things, I mean, that is a hardcore explanation of a vision quest.
Right. Yeah. The other, I mean, there's this element involved, and I incorporated into the last blog because I felt it's crucial, but it requires a bit of study to get the full significance, and it has to do with Titus Caesar, right? And how Jesus in the gospel story says repeatedly that he is the messenger. Jesus is the messenger. He's not the one. The one is the Son of Man. Now, you talk to Christians, especially fundamentalist Christians, and they're like, no, he is the Son of Man who's going to return. And so everyone talks about the return of Jesus. But he never says that. He never says, I will come back. He says the Son of Man will come back. And it's always in the third person in the Greek.
Right.
And so, and there's this assumption the reason that assumption is there is because after the gospel story, in the rest of the books, Acts, Romans, Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, Thessalonians, all of that, they all basically have Jesus as, they emphasize repeatedly that he is the one. But
those are other people speaking, not
the gospel.
Right.
And so I'm just like, you know, what, everything that he predicts will happen, that the Son of Man will accomplish, is accomplished by Titus Caesar within the same time frame that he says, in the same order that he says. And if you go through Josephus Flavius's text, who's the only other surviving text from that area and that era of the world besides the gospel story, with the exception of a Roman botanist who just wrote about plants and stuff, is, you know, that Titus is referred to repeatedly as the Son of Man and the only Son of God, because Vespasian Caesar, who's in Rome, is God. And so by extension, he's the Son of God. And so I'm tripping out on the idea of, you have this character that they're showing you in the artwork from the time with the sun behind him.
Yeah.
And he stands for it. It's like they're emphasizing that this is Mercury. And if you're not paying attention, you're going to worship what stands before, what is eclipsing the thing. But then they're taking the sun to be this Roman ruler. So you're not seeing that you're worshiping a Roman ruler, you're worshiping this thing that's in the way. And so it's like a trick. And so I don't know. I feel like that sounds crazy, but you can actually back it up for days and days and days and days. And the problem with...
Sorry, are you taking this as this person was intentionally trying to fulfill the prophecy to sort of put themselves in that place? Do you take that as a possibility of...
I take it as the idea that there was a prophecy, yes.
Right. But I'm saying, if you know the prophecy, like right now, I can go pull up a book of Nostradamus and then start doing those things and go, hey, check it out, I'm this guy. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you could take a prophecy and then... And that's actually a problem right now we have, is that fundamentalist Christians are intentionally trying to fulfill aspects of end times prophecy as a way of essentially... Hey, if we start putting these things into place, the Messiah is going to come. So
right.
The problem is, well, the prophecy says you need to have this, you know, horrible war and genocide. Oh, I guess we got to go, you know, start that. And right. just, you know, because the end result is we're going to bring God back. So it's right. there are elements of people, you know, taking the prophecy into their own hands is a possibility. The other possibility is that it's written, you know, sort of you have that you have your history accounts phrase you in such a way to match that someone after the fact, do we know that actually during the time that he ruled he was referred to as Son of Man, or was he, you know, is this something that historians, or they had sort of built the history afterwards?
Well, Josephus Flavius was a Jew who was captured by the Romans and adopted into the Flavian court, and
very golden bough,
right? And so, I mean, the story goes, and I forget, I think it's in the Midrash or something, but they have it where he's standing in a line and with a bunch of Jews, and one by one they're like, bow before Caesar, and they refuse, and so one by one they die, and he chose to stand at the end of the line. So once they're all dead, he bows, and that's how they have it. But anyway, the fact of the matter is that he became Josephus Flavius. Right. Which he was not before. That was a title that was given to him. And he was extremely intellectual. He's a scholar and extremely familiar with the Bible, the Old Testament. And so there's this argument that's given by Joseph Atwill, who, once again, I don't agree with everything that he says. I feel like he discredits a lot of his root stuff because he wants to drive it home further, which is a common issue amongst people who write books. you know, because you got this point and you can back it up, but then you want to emphasize it, and in doing so you kind of discredit yourself. But anyways, he you know, gives this whole argument for how you could argue that Josephus and a group of intellectuals basically wrote the gospel story as a means of military control, and how it's the reason why it's a mindfuck is that it's basing itself off of a religion that already existed amongst the people, and then twisting it enough so to, and then it's also like a kind of a joke on them in many respects. It's like satire, but you don't see the satire unless if you're familiar enough with all the implications, and so that's kind of the idea. And so anyways, I was just tripping out on that, and then the idea that you have Mystery Babylon, which is what's coming out of that, because they're basically making a foundation so that if the empire should happen to fall, they can maintain power through religion. Basically they're looking to build this thing that, you know, no, the nations falling won't stop it, because it's already in place, and it's been, the way that it's expressed is that it's been grafted onto a pre-existing tree, and so they take a tree that exists and then they graft onto it, and that's hinted at in the Josephus text in all kinds of ways. And if you read Caesar's Messiah by Joseph Atwill, you'll see what I'm talking about. It's like a vine that they attach to this tree. And I was tripping out on the fact that you have this tree that's the tree of life, the holistic thing, and then you have these people, as a matter of fact, try to do everything they could to destroy that old version. These people who I'm reading had to hide their shit away, you know, because it was, there's no surviving text from that area, you know, what the fuck, you know. So,
well, I think that's you know, the common thing that people do is they go and they destroy, and this is why book burnings. It's so funny because Ray Bradbury just died yesterday, right? So
day before, right? During the Venus transit.
Was that two? I have no sense of time anymore. Yeah, but within the last 2 days.
On the 18th of the 5th.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So right. So speaking, you know, of course, wrote Fahrenheit 451. So. But the thing is, you know, there have been book burnings all around the world. You know, the conquistadors did it. It's happened in China. It's happened to the natives. It's happened to all the South Americans. I mean, the idea is that you know, and it's a funny thing happens because you ultimately, this is how you end up with, I think, how you end up with secret societies, and not just the people who bury the information and hold on to it for themselves, but the maybe the people who know the information and want to try and sort of pass it down through the generations. You have to be really secretive about it. And then over time, secrecy can lead to corruption and things like that. So it's not that these things are inherently bad. It's just that I think ultimately they sort of come out of these situations. Have you, there's a documentary, which I find it just sort of smacks of a sort of anti-Semitic ideology that I find really taints the work. But there's this documentary called Ring of Power. Have you seen those?
Yeah, I've seen it, and I went to show it to my girlfriend, but I had started watching it like halfway through, like the night before, and I was like, whoa, dude, this guy has done his fucking research.
Exactly. I mean,
and
he's just really laying
it all out. And then I watched the beginning, and I'm just like, oh, damn, it's totally fucking fear-based, and he's ignorant of all this important shit at the same time.
Right.
Weird.
That's what I'm saying. Okay. So I have really mixed feelings about it, but I believe in that. It's that film where they lay out the idea that, if you have this idea of Moses as Akhenaten, and then Jesus as perhaps the child of Julius Caesar and Cleopatra, or so, I think it's that movie that I could be wrong. I think it's Ring of Power, where they sort of try and posit this idea where
I remember they showed this was like months ago, but I remember they showed all the different rulers and equate them with the different characters of the Old Testament, and then I don't remember the Jesus part, but I didn't watch the whole thing, so.
Yeah, it's sort of like interesting to throw it in there that if you had that this sort of marriage of if the Abrahamic, which just, you know, I don't know, run with their theory for a moment. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily accurate, obviously, but just run with the theory for a moment, is that if the Abrahamic sort of, you're everyone down from King David down to, you know, Joseph is sort of in this weird, pharaonic relationship where the Egyptian kings are, you know, and I guess we even have this story, right, with Joseph, Joseph, Technicolor Dreamcoat, ends up, he ends up working with the pharaohs. Moses is adopted. So you have this same sort of common motif of this crossover between the Abrahamic, I don't want to say kings, but you know what I mean, like the sort of powerhouses.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of struggling for the word there, but the sort of powerhouses of that, overlapping. And then what you see where with Cleopatra, you have now where the Roman Empire is mixing with that power structure. So, I mean, there's room to argue that if they're all sort of either in bed with each other, I mean, and you know, both literally and figuratively, that you could have them set up their own offspring as, you know, these messiah figures, you know, fairly easily. I believe their argument was that there's a story where like Cleopatra's child goes and travels for a certain number of years and is sort of out of the historical record for this window, and it's in this window where sort of Jesus arrives on the scene. It's really interesting, but I find their stuff really hard to sort of digest, not for any other reason than it's, like I said, I just find it really tainted, and it's hard for me to sort of take it seriously. But
right. Well, there's an inevitable oversimplification.
Correct.
That tends to happen with it. When I was in school, when I was younger, I went to a Christian school, which I eventually got expelled from. But I was raised with that, and there, it was in my middle school, it was very academic oriented. Now I talk to people who go to Christian schools, and their description isn't as in depth in that regard. And so we did a lot of studying of that area and that era, you know, on the other side too, of Old and New Testament, you know, was pretty in depth. And so, you know, this, you're familiar with the Sicarii, you know, basically the Jewish rebels who were against the occupation of Rome.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of these people did, when Romans started showing up, they didn't know what Rome was. They didn't know the full depth. They were just like, these people keep showing up. You know, who are these people? They didn't know what they were up against. They just saw that there was more and more of these people showing up in these fucking outfits, you know? They're like, okay. And then it reaches a certain point and they're like, you know, fuck this. And so that it was, there was these people that weren't submitting like the rest of the nations were. And it went on for 100 years, these people not going with the program. And so they're like, what the fuck? And they're like, okay, well, these people have this religion. You know, what is it? You know, and so they were. It's very, very plausible. It's not that far out of an idea that there was this manipulation that took place. But then the implications that keep going get more and more interesting. Like, and then the fact that they're modeling everything after Babylon in terms of the empire, and so I find that very. You know, when I look at the image of Jesus before the sun, you know, I'm considering the Babylonian sun square and the fact that that's the foundation for the empire. And so how strange it is that Jesus is eclipsing it. You know, you can control people through it's like a distraction that's standing in the way, you know. And then you won't see what it is that he's standing. It's like the best place to hide something is in plain sight.
Right.
Kind of idea, you know, and that it seems like they fucking pulled it off pretty well, you know, and it didn't hurt things that things were esoteric in the first place when it comes to the tree and whatnot, you know.
What do you take of the idea that Chris Knowles had written about this idea that basically, I've read the sort of expression or description elsewhere, but the idea that, you know, when Rome or even Western Europe, when they tried to sort of take over Europe, even like taking their relics and trying to take power of Egypt, they, on the surface, win, you know, they conquer, but culturally Egypt conquers them, that they end up assuming so much of their rituals, deities, cult, you know, just the sort of the culture that comes with it, that in the end Egypt conquers them, at least, you know, as a sort of ideology. What do you take of the idea that perhaps these people could say, all right, we're going to graft our vine onto this tree, but ultimately then the growth of your vine, you're going to go where the tree goes. Do you know what I mean? That tree is still
sort of... Well, that's the Shakina.
Right.
So that's the essence of the thing. And that's also, for the Egyptians, that's, what's her name? Who's the image? Hathor. Napoleon, as he conquers Egypt, etches out fucking every image of Hathor painstakingly. It's insane because it took us so long to even know what Hathor looked like because we had to dig down deep enough to find a fucking statue that's pre-Napoleon, you know, and it looks like fucking one of the Greys or something. She's a unique face, you know. She's got like the almost the pear-shaped head. You know Hathor? You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, very much so. Hold on one second, or you can keep talking. Sure. I have to move my desk for this guy. Hold on.
Okay.
You can keep going, man.
Okay, so, you know, okay. Napoleon etches out every one of these images all across Egypt painstakingly. She looks like fucking one of the Greys or whatever. There's this whole... idea with the Shakina that she's basically, in description, she's the essence of all martial arts. because in martial arts, you yield to overcome, right? The Shakina is basically ultimate receptivity. She's one with the Tetragrammaton. She's part of the name, you know. She's the final hey. And so there's this idea that you have this necessary part for rejuvenating the tree, because the tree is a living thing, right? And so it's ultimately meant to be folded into itself as the star, and she is to be married with the air, which is her masculine counterpart. And in doing so, you have this mutually interdependent flow, which is like, it's been pointed out by the Maru Foundation that the first part of Bereshit is basically expresses this Taurus, and you have the whole bagel theory, right, where you have this constant rejuvenation that happens through this flow. And when you separate the tree, you basically are you can only keep it that way for so long. It's like the idea that truth always wins in the end.
Can I just say that I think ultimately the idea of the bagel theory, as you say, the sort of the Taurus, right? I don't know if I've already told this to you, but basically think about it. You call it a Taurus is this bagel. Taurus, of course, is also the bull. Hathor is a cow goddess, okay? Mm-hmm. And if you take it back to Tarot, we say the wheel of the Tarot speaks the law of the goddess Hathor. Well, what is the wheel of the Tarot? Perhaps the wheel of the Tarot is that Taurus, is that bagel. Do you get me?
Yes, I do. And also find it interesting, when you look at the alchemical symbols of these things, the way that you have the symbol for Taurus is the upper part of Mercury, and how the lower part of Mercury is Venus. Yeah. And you have, I don't think, and then when you look at the relationship of those to the Sphirot and how it changed over time, and the way that they were rearranged, I'm at a place where I don't think any of it's just a mistake.
Have you seen the images of the glyphs for Venus and Mercury being created from the Tree of Life?
Yes.
Right? Oh, you see? Okay, you know what I'm saying. So, like, sort of
that was
just in retracing the paths, but if you keep the sphere in their same position and just connect them differently, you can create the glyphs, same glyph.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, totally. And so, I mean, yeah, I'm just, for me, I'm looking at it, and what's just staring at me is the fact that it's like, Israel Regarde is there with the Golden Dawn, right? Making these associations. Meanwhile, he's got access to this text. I don't think he can read Hebrew. Most likely what it is that there's translations that aren't available to the public at all of Ramak. And then these people have probably Mathers, and these people have access to this, or at least some of it. Specifically the Garden of Pomegranates, which is hinted at, like I said earlier, from Regarde. And so I'm just like, well, if they have access to these associations, why are they coming up with their own? Like, that don't exist before, with the Ari or from anybody else. And so, like, that's questionable. And it's not Eliphas Levy. Like, what the fuck?
I mean, just as a devil's advocate here, I mean, a lot of what we're doing is, you know, while at the same time we're studying the old systems, we are, in a sense, trying to reinterpret a lot of this stuff. Is it possible that you're saying if they had access to it, why are they coming up with their own? Could it be, it's like, you know, just
well, I mean, we're also acknowledging it's one thing to come up with another interpretation. It's another thing to change the very foundation and then to never mention there was different associations. These people never mention that there was different associations. They don't go into that. They're like, here it is, that's that. This is our system. And so that, and then the implications of that system in relationship to the other one make me question. I'm like, wow, especially when you move Mars around, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, huh.
It's to me, you know, since we're talking about Shekinah, I mean, you know, if you look at the Solomon's temple, you have all these layers of curtains, basically layers of veils. And when you talk about eclipsing something and these different, almost multiple layers of obscuration, it seems to me very much the same concept of, like, you know, one layer isn't enough. We got to put three or four curtains before this damn thing, and you just got to kind of keep peeling if you really want to get there.
Right. And so it is available on some level for those who wish to go deeper. But I think a lot of people that belong to these organizations or study these things are satisfied. They're like, okay, this works. And then that's that. And so basically where I'm at is I'm like, I think it's interesting to look at what they're showing, but I don't want to stop there. And I want to cross-reference. And when I do cross-reference, implications come up out of it. And those implications all feel significant for the most part. And so that's where I'm at, you know. I kept flashing to, like, the film Metropolis, and how there's this line, I'm probably going to get it wrong, but it's something along the lines of the intermediary between the mind and the hand has to be the heart.
Correct, yes.
And how this whole thing with the heart being Mercury, which is the messenger, being replaced with the sun, which is the source, is just, that's like, and then that feels like such a key thing there,
so,
you know.
Sorry, take a look at the movie Metropolis. So not only do you have that same image again of the woman, the sort of pure spirit, perhaps our Shekinah, being replaced by an android copy. And what does that android copy, the Whore of Babylon, what does she wear but a sort of fanned headdress, which is very much like as if she were eclipsing a sun.
Right. Exactly. And I don't with Metropolis, none of that's a mistake. She is there for the slaves. She's slaves, receptive leader.
Correct, yeah. Exactly.
It's basically, we yield to overcome. This is how we do it. She's a revolutionary, but not a revolutionary like you'd expect. And then you have, she's played by Lilith, and that is the Whore of Babylon. She's the queen of the Klippot. She's the shell, meaning she's like a golem.
She's an
intelligence that's not the thing. So it's obviously, once again, it's multi-layered, right? But this idea that you're looking at the implications of the tree, like if you were to look at it as the chakral system, which is totally done in the old text when they describe the tree, you don't flip the tree. If you flip the tree to step into it and you end up with a mirror of the tree, that's the backside of the tree. That's not actually the tree. Like, if you're looking at a representation of the tree, you literally step into it if you want to know its placements on your body.
Right.
You don't turn it around.
Right.
But what's interesting is, like I say, if you do turn it around and you look at the text on the backside of the tree where you have the Klippot that rule the Sphirot, that's everything's in reverse. And so, you know, and then, but then it's interesting because within the tree itself in the first place, you have like a mirror on both sides, like Chesed is the opposite of Gevurah. So, you know, in a sense, they're opposites, but they're not in opposition. They can be in opposition if they're misinterpreted. And so I'm looking at, if you want to control a populace, you turn one side against each other. That's why gangs are encouraged in prisons, right? You want to keep people in conflict, because out of chaos comes order. You can maintain order from the lower parts being in conflict with each other, because then they can't organize, right? So I'm looking at the tree itself, and I'm like, well, what happens when you switch? If you want to maintain real control, you keep people in conflict with themselves. And so there's this idea of when the contrasts are seen as conflict, it's not recognized as an undivided spectrum of being where one point doesn't end and where the other side begins, that they're actually a continuum. But you turn these opposites against each other, so the opposites are in opposition, then you can maintain extreme control. And so I wonder if that's like part of the gospel's methodology, is to basically bring out a conflict from, you know, you give unto Caesar's what is Caesar's, and meanwhile, everything else, it's like, it's not completely conducive integration. It's like if you listen to a speech of Martin Luther King, everything follows.
Right.
There are no contradictions. That's actually like a complete integrated ideology. Then you look at Mein Kampf and you can see, wait a minute, that didn't actually follow. A plus B did not equal C. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yet if people go for it, then it puts them into an internalized conflict. And then because of that conflict, you can control them. So that's... Yeah.
All right, here. He then, being pulled down, who also cast his first state down upon the earth, established this whole disposition of all things, being hanged up an image of the creation, wherein he made the things of the right hand into the left hand, and the left hand into the right hand, and changed about all the marks of their nature, so that he thought those things that were not fair to be fair, and those that were in truth to evil to be good, concerning which the Lord saith in a mystery, unless he make the things of the right hand as those of the left, and those of the left as those of the right, and those that are above as those below, and those that are behind as those that are before, ye shall not have knowledge of the kingdom.
Is that New Testament?
James.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's pretty interesting.
Totally.
You know, so we, I mean, to me, I think this sort of reversal is, you know, for me, it's not an inherently bad thing. It also allows for a shift in perspective. You know, we take the hanged man of the Tarot. I know a lot of people take that as a very negative image. I've known a lot of people who took it that way. But I mean, it's also the idea of a sort of meditative perspective shift. So to me, it's not inherently bad to sort of switch it. You know, it's sort of like there's like an old cliched expression, like you know, walk a mile in the other man's shoes, or you sort of this idea of looking at it from the flip side to get perhaps a better understanding of it. I just don't think it's inherently bad. I don't think anything's inherently bad.
That's completely it. I don't feel that there's any way around this thing, and that the most destructive act you can come up with has its opposite things come up out of it, and that's just how it works.
Okay, wonderful. That's a wonderful...
You split the atom, and right. Then you end up with an expansion that you didn't expect.
That's the segue I wanted, is to bring this back to the splitting of the atom. I want to ask you, since we're talking about this idea of actually opening something else up, what do you make of the fact that Oppenheimer, who says, you know, I am become death, over years we've come to the idea that the actual correct translation is not death, but time. So he would essentially be saying, I am become time. It's almost like as if opening the fourth dimension, or you know, something along these lines of stepping into a temporal role rather than a physical role. Which, of course, the flip side being LSD, then you would have this idea that, wait a second, I'm experiencing an ego death, but I'm actually becoming one with the entire timeline.
So what does death have that also time has? Time is Father Time is Saturn, right?
Of course, yeah, exactly.
And then
exactly.
You have death has the fucking sieve, right? Yeah. Is that what you call it? Sieve. Which you use to separate the wheat from the chaff. What does Jesus say, but you separate the wheat from the chaff, right? It's this whole idea. But then you have ergot is a byproduct of rye, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So there's this whole, and what you use to fucking collect the rye, right? So it's
and
just...
consider that even... So, I mean, to me, Saturn, in all his forms, you know, Osiris, Saturn, Father Time, the reason they have this is they're commonly associated with agriculture. So they're not just the lord of time and death, but they're the lord of agriculture. Now, this could be a very simple metaphor for agricultural cycles of things are sort of born, you know, just your life cycle that you observe as a farmer. Okay, things die, you go into winter, things die off, then they're going to be born again next spring. So you have this sort of time cycle, seasonal cycle that you associate with agriculture. But Osiris, lord of grain, you know, he's associated with corn and all these plants. Jesus, to me, same thing. He's a god who dies and is reborn. I see him very much equated with Osiris in that sense. And what is he? He's, of course, an agricultural god because he is the grapes. You know, he's the drink of my blood, eat of my body. If his body is bread, well, then I'm sorry. He's a fucking man of wheat, a man of grain.
That's what outright.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the whole thing. Yeah. I keep thinking right now of Yellow Submarine when they look out the window and they're like, they see, oh, it's Father Time. I thought it was Father Xmas, you know? And you can see that when they age really quickly and right before 64, and then you have like 64 tetrahedrons make up the double isotropic vector metric, which is how you produce the most stable form in all of geometry, which you can extrapolate all the platonic solids out of, which is absolute counterbalance. It's basically the perfection of the I Ching in three-dimensional form. So you have 64 hexagrams make up the I Ching, 64 tetrahedrons that make up this isotropic vector metric, which is the flower of life in living expression, you know. And so I trip out that they do when I'm 64 coming up out of seeing Saturn there.
I just think it's pretty insane. And what did we figure out last week? Was they went to Pepperland, and I was trying to remember what did we figure out last week?
Oh, the foothills of the headlands.
Yes, exactly.
Right, which I was thinking about just recently of Keter and Malkut, even though Malkut doesn't mean foot. But as far as they were concerned, if they were looking at European occultists, they would think that. Malkut is the tip of the genitals. For women, it would be the clit. For males, it would just be the tip of the dick, you know. It's basically the most sensitive point is the Malkut, which is also the Shekinah, which is important to remember. So, which has its interesting implications there, because you're taking the thing that would ultimately be in touch with the cosmos, and you're funneling it down into the final point, and then you're extracting pleasure out of the thing. And that's how it's described. That's the exile. And so then you think about Kundalini and all of that from the tantric system and all its implications, because she is sexual energy. She's like the highest form of sexual energy. And so then it's all Jason's genius work with Lolita being, the Lamed, but then that becomes Lilith. But then all the levels, he can back that up for days, you know. And so we were tripping out on, I was tripping out on Jezebel from Jacob's Ladder, and the story of Jezebel and how she's fed to the dogs and all this. And she was the one who killed off the prophets and brought in all the prophets of Moloch, but I don't think it's Moloch. I forget who it was that she led in, but anyway, it was the God.
What do you take of, so then Jason realized this week that in Head, the woman who's standing at the top of the building that's going to jump, right, and I think it was Mark LeClaire that said she was in red, like the Whore of Babylon. She was the lady in red. But Jason pointed out she's in a bikini. So we go back to the bikini atoll, this idea of splitting the atom again. And,
oh, God. There was that. Did you read that article about Rita Hayworth?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Dude, that was so good. Oh,
now,
God.
Did you read in the history of the bikini that when the bikini was created, there was another fashion line that had come out before it called like Atome or something, A-T-O-M-E or something like that, or E-T-O-M-E, and that they had advertised themselves as the smallest swimsuit available. And then the bikini came out, and because it was the Atome was still a one piece, so they jokingly said the bikini was the splitting of the Atome. So it's like this fashion joke of, ah, ha, ha, we took that and we just basically cut it in half. Then, of course, we do, but now I've also read that the bikini was so named for Bikini Atoll that this idea of this sort of shocking, moment.
I just had a weird one. Okay.
It's really weird. Bizarre. But then you realize, well, Lita is wearing the bikini.
What about Bob? Names his fucking fish Gil. Okay. The fish is the vesica, right? Which is the split. When you have two spheres or two circles and you go to split them, you end up with the vesica.
Of course, yeah. Did you say, what about Bob?
Yeah, what about Bob when he names his fish Gil?
And then I was thinking
Gilda. Gilda is Rita Hayworth.
Did you have no idea that I was just talking about What About Bob? Where did you get that? How did you jump into What About Bob?
It just came to mind.
Get the fuck out of here. Last night, I emailed. That is so crazy.